So it's second installment of the podcast series coming live from the Retail Bulletin in London. I think Omnichannel episode 5. And this is a brilliant episode. It is Omnichannel, but I tell you, there's a whole load of other lessons, learnings, inspirations that you're going to take from this conversation with Chrissy Smith, the founder of Bird & Blend Tea. One definitely not to miss. So I'm now delighted to be joined by Chrissy Smith, who is the owner, founder.
Yep, that'll do.
Pretty much everything. Yeah, everything of Bird & Blend Tea. And I've met you twice now, two similar conferences talking about retail and omnichannel. And I've been blown away by what you've had to say to the audience. So you've built a brilliant brand. So it's great to sit and talk to you about omnichannel. But, you know, from a really interesting angle and the fact that you've kind of taken a product to market. So before we do all of that, it'd be great just to for you to introduce yourself, because you'll do a far better job than me. Just, you know, tell everyone who you are, what you do, a bit about your brand.
Sure. So my name is Chrissy Smith, and I am one of the co-founders and the owner, I guess, of Bird & Blend Tea Company. We are expert tea mixologists, which we coined that phrase, so
like it.
Waiting to see if it takes off. but it basically means we're expert tea blenders. We create all different weird and wonderful flavours of tea, and we sell them through 14 of our own high street stores and through our website, D2C, with a very small amount of wholesale as well. We started 10 years ago, a very traditional startup story. You know, my mum let me borrow the back bedroom for 6 months and then said, like, get a proper job, Chrissy. And went to markets and events, and the kind of the purpose and the drive, I guess the why behind why I wanted to start a business was to have a business that was providing like actual connections, very human focused. So we say like human first on both sides of the counter. So I wanted to employ people and kind of create amazing jobs done in the right way. I wanted it to be a retail, you know, type of business, because I wanted to give great customer experiences. So we've just, that was waffle, but that's the long shot.
Brilliant. If that's waffle, it's brilliant. Because I mean, it's quite similar actually to the business I work for now, which is the Donaldson Group, and it's a family business. And that's the purpose of the business as well, is employment, and it's people first, and it's, you know, creating positive futures now and for generations to come. And it sounds like you've kind of, you know, set up your business in a very similar, with a very similar purpose, which is amazing.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because most people in the food and drink industry, they start a business because they've got a passion for the product, and then usually the goal is to get it listed in grocery, right? Whereas my co-founder Mike and I wanted to build a business that was doing it in the right way, and tea was the vehicle that we ended up settling on. So we kind of did it backwards. And I am a tea expert now. I'm an author. I'm our chief mixologist. I create all of the teas. But when I started, I didn't know much about tea at all. I was just passionate about building a business that did it in a better way. And you know, along the years, we've had many of a well-intended piece of advice around, you know, don't start a retail business when the high street is dying, don't employ loads of people, it'll be a HR nightmare, you know, don't add all that extra cost onto your bottom line. If you've got a great product, just, you know, sell it into grocery. And we've had the opportunity to do that. You know, we've turned down most of the major supermarkets over the years. And when you say that, sometimes people are a bit like, why would you do that? But we just didn't really have a passion to be account managers. We wanted to, what got us out of bed was this purpose behind the business, and that's what's kept us doing it through 10 long hard years.
Oh my,
you know?
God, I've got so many questions to follow up on that. That is amazing. So let me start with, like, I mean, that must have been a tough decision. I mean, it's hats off in terms of the approach. That's incredible. But like, talk me through your thought process when people were saying, you know, don't start physical retail, and, you know, don't, you know, just sell into the big grocers. Talk me through what was going through the head when you were like, nah, I'm going against that. And no, I'm not going to turn these big retailers down that were probably offering you some big numbers to sell your tea into. But yeah, I love this. Tell me.
I think it was well, I was just so naive and also stubborn at the beginning that, you know, even though I knew there were people that were way more experienced than me, sort of experts in the field, and also, you know, well, it was well-intended advice, and, you know, I almost didn't know what I didn't know. And I, again, because it came back to why we wanted to start the business, I would just, every time I got tempted by someone else that was way smarter than me, that had way more experience, you know, I don't have a business degree, I have no qualifications in business whatsoever. I just learned as I've gone along. And I would just go back to, does that, ultimately, does that really make me happy? Like, does that make my heart sing? And because it was, we were growing a startup, and one of the things was, let's build a business that we love being in, I had the luxury of saying, I don't want to do that, actually. It wasn't a strategic commercial decision. You know, it wasn't about that. And it was about having some fun on the way, and kind of the success of the business almost hit us a bit in the face when we were like, oh God, actually, this isn't just kind of a fun, purpose-driven kind of adventure we're on. This is actually succeeding, and we're going to have to take this a bit more serious commercially. you know, but not so much that the fun, you know, completely leaves yeah. it. You know, I don't have any desire to have a whole board of investors that tell me that I can't, you know, open a matcha bar when because I want to do that, you know, because it'll be really cool and I think there's a market for that, but it's probably not going to make us a load of money. It's definitely not a great ROI. But, you know, I don't want that in... I have the luxury of that as a founder, that yeah. I've built my environment around me to be able to make those decisions. That's not to say there aren't a lot of cons, you know, it is difficult. There's a lot of downsides to that, but you just stuck to my guns, really, I think. And I can remember my first meeting that I had with, had to find the suppliers of tea, right? So I knew I wanted to create these flavors of tea in the early days. And I was like, right, well, how am I going to do this? I can remember going and speaking to they're still one of our suppliers now, but like, it's got a history in like Unilever and like properly trained tea blender. And I was like, right, I want to make a mojito flavored tea. And he was like, what? I was like, well, you know, like, I want it to be like lime and lemongrass and green tea, because, you know, nobody likes the taste of green tea, and I want big slices of lime in there. And he was like, yeah, that's not the tea industry. That'll never work. You can't put chunks of fruit in tea. This is not going to work.
You're going to tell me this is your best selling
tea. It is one of our best sellers, yeah. And again, I think it's because I was just so naive and so stubborn about, well, let's just give it a go. You know, nobody's done it. There might be a reason why nobody's done this, but I'm going to find out.
I love it.
And if I fall on my face, I fall on my face.
Brilliant. I mean, there's people listening to this, like, just like stopping this podcast now and going off and writing a business plan of how they're going to just go and live their best life. It's amazing. I'd have to sample this tea now.
Mojito, it's called.
Mojito.
Yeah, you know it's bad when you know now these days when I'm at the bar and I try and order a mojito, I say, "Can I have a mojito?" Like, oh
God, you're just trying to get the brand out there, aren't you?
Yeah.
I tell you what, Darren just on the stage, he just came off obviously a panel conversation, and Darren, who was moderating your session, is a big fan of yours, and
yeah,
he's kind of doing his job. He, in fact, you were out the room, and he's still promoting your brand. To be honest. So let's talk about your expansion, because you say you've 14 branches now on the high street. Yeah. How long did that take you to roll out those 14 branches?
Great question. So we started at markets and events. We didn't have any money. And just wanted to get into anything. So we did anything from, we got into Glastonbury Festival, but all the way down to like Bakewell Town Hall, you know, WI or whatever. So we did a big range, and we did food festivals, we did music festivals, we did all sorts of different things. But the aim was to get a retail store open. And we ended up going down to Brighton for a food festival, had a great weekend, sold out of everything at the festival. And we happened to walk past a store, a record shop, actually, in the North Lanes, which is this really vibrant indie space. And we went in looking for records, because we're both a big fan of records. And got chatting to the man behind the counter, and he said, oh, I own this place. I own the building. I've been here for 30 years. This is my wife. We run it together. I'm retiring. I'm looking to retire. Anyway, it turns out he wants to hand the shop over to someone that will love it as much as him. And his wife was Anita Roddick's first store manager. So when we started talking about our like ambitions to like sell tea out of retail, we all fell in love with each other and gushing and all of this. Anyway, so with a bit of a handshake, we ended up accidentally with our first retail store in Brighton. So we like packed all our belongings, moved to Brighton, slept on the shop floor, because I don't know if anyone's attempted to move from the Midlands to Brighton, but it's a shock to the system. You don't know how the rent is, yeah. So we ended up accidentally with the store, and then we thought we'll trade it a year. Mike and I worked the shop floor every day, and then we'd go downstairs and pack the tea for the online orders in the basement. We're like, well, we'll make sure this works, and then we'll recruit a team, and then we'll open number two. And at that time, we did have him, you know, early stage kind of interest in from investors around like, well, if we invest this amount, why don't you open 10? And that was another really hard decision. So we were like, could we do that? Maybe. Do we want to do that? I don't know. But we decided we wanted to sort of more gradually open the first couple of stores to really bulletproof like our structure and our model. And we had loads of infrastructure stuff we had to figure out, like how are we going to stock that many stores and without a warehouse, a basement of a Brighton store, you know, that sort of thing. How are we going to recruit store managers? I don't know what I'm doing. I've never recruited anyone before. So we decided to take it gradually, but we had a massive shock to the system because we then realised that getting a retail lease is nowhere near as easy as happening upon someone in a record shop. They were like, have you got accounts? We're like, no. Have you got architectural plans? I was like, no. Do you have a rent deposit? No. So it took us two further years to get the next couple of stores open. And then we kind of felt like we'd really, you know, we'd really sort of cracked it. So we crowdfunded for some cash and opened four additional stores in a year, nearly killed us, both personally and professionally. And then coming into COVID, we had seven. And then we opened more during COVID, which again was an interesting decision. But yeah, basically, so many great spaces were, unfortunately, brands were going under. So these great retail spaces were there. And we had a conversation like, are we daft to be getting leases when we can't even open the stores, and who knows what's going to happen? Everyone's saying digital's going to take over. And I was kind of like, well, it's in for a penny and for a pound at the moment, isn't it? Like, we've already got seven, so we're kind of screwed if it doesn't work. So we took on four new stores during COVID that couldn't open. So by the time we came out of lockdown, we had to open these four new sites, and yeah, we're hoping to open six more this year.
Wow.
I know.
That is a story.
I know, that was a long story, so you have to edit that down.
None of that is getting edited. It's all gold. And so how did you choose your locations? Can I rewind a minute? Because you started with an e-commerce and one store, is that right?
Yes.
Did you start the e-commerce first?
Yes.
So how long did you have the e-commerce running before you set up your first store?
So we set up the e-com pretty much from day one. But when I say e-com, it was a big commerce site that I YouTubed how, like, I was on, like, you know, what was it called back then? Like Paint, trying to make banners that were just images that were HTML upload. Like it was horrendous. It had two pages on the website, the homepage and a list of teas. It was so bad. And it used to make this noise. It used to go ka-ching when we had an order on my phone, and we'd get like four a week or something. And I'd be like, oh my God, we've got an order. But we set that up from kind of the day one when we were doing the markets and the events and the pop-up shops and things, because we wanted, because people were saying like, where do we buy it? And we were like, oh, you know, and so we knew we needed the website so that people could then buy it after they'd met us at an event. But it was very small. And then by the time we opened the first store, the Brighton store, 2 years later, the e-com was kind of picking up a bit, and we decided to invest in replatforming and kind of making that better. But it was still just Mike and I at that time. So like, one of us would be sorting out the e-com. He'd be on, like, I'd be doing that. He'd be on the shop floor, you know. Yeah. And then it just kind of scaled and scaled and scaled. And it's now just over half of the business are e-com. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. So now up to your, so you've got 14 branches. Yeah. How did you decide on, right, we've heard about the first one, and that's just amazing. You just stumbled across the first location. But then how did you decide on locations for your rollout of physical? And is that going to differ from the next six that you're going to open?
Yeah, good question. So Brighton did kind of accidentally, we found out, kind of by doing it, that Brighton was a really great location for store number one, because it was a destination city, so people were visiting it, having a great time, and then leaving. So we noticed that people were popping into Brighton, having a great day by the beach, picking up some tea and as a souvenir of their trip to Brighton, going back to wherever they live in the world, and then they associate us with their great trip and we're repurchasing online. We also, they're a very foodie community, very open community, very liberal, very multicultural, lots of students as well. And that seemed to really, really resonate. Like that kind of became our demographic. So from then we looked at our orders online, like where people were ordering from, and then combined that with cities that we thought were tourist destinations for like day tripping or weekend breaks that had student population and that were pretty open-minded, kind of not trendy, but like kind of a bit hipster, a bit sort of out there, because our brand is a bit out there. It's like wacky tea. So, you know, so we looked for those locations down to the street. We made a list of streets across the country, and then we would just scour the listings and as soon as one came up, we would go and visit it, and we would visit it in the, you know, in the rain, in the sunshine, in the evening, and like literally just stand outside and count the number of people walking past with buggies, count the number of people with shopping bags, count the number of people with student tags. So very old school market research methods there. But so far we've only had to resite one store out of 14. So
it's a good ratio.
We really don't, and that was our first attempt to go into a shopping centre, and the shopping centre declined. So it lost its flagship unit. So I don't think that's bad going out of 14.
Very good going. Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. And I love the approach of, you know, the research that you've done, understanding the customers and the locations. I heard you speak on this last panel, and I loved the way you answered this question, because somebody asked you about, you know, recreating that sort of physical experience in your branch online. And you very honestly said you're not trying to do that. Which I think is great, because a lot of brands, you know, try and sort of that whole blended retail piece of saying, well, it has to be the same experience online and offline. And you're quite clear about the experiences that each of your channels are given to your customers. Can you give us a little bit of a snapshot into that? Because I think that's really insightful in terms of like truly understanding what element of your brand's physical and digital plays as part of your overall strategy.
Yeah, I think that people can get lost in the word of like omnichannel and all those other buzzwords, in thinking that you have to do exactly the same thing across everything. And I actually think that the crux of it is figuring out what your customers use each bit for, and understanding that they're not in lanes, and we're not in departments. There's not a digital department and a retail department. I mean, there is logistically, but we're all there for the same customer. They're just doing different things at different points. So we did spend years trying to replicate the amazing in-store experience. We knew we had an amazing in-store experience. It's top of the list in all the customer feedback surveys. It was generating amazing word of mouth referral and stuff. We weren't having to pay for it. You know, up until 3 years ago, our top acquisition channel digitally was still organic word of mouth. It was above paid media. It was our fans, once they've had an experience in store, they will tell people about it. It's like obsession level, like love of the brand, which I'm very grateful for.
That's amazing. You
know? But the tricky thing is then, okay, we know we've got this. How do we gain new customers digitally in this completely, you know, we want to grow, we want to expand the brand. We can't open on every high street. So why, you know, let's use our digital site and different channels to acquire more customers and bring them into the world. How do we replicate the in-store experience? Well, the long and short of it is we just can't, because the in-store experience is about the smelling, the tasting, the team, that it's built for a human experience with humans. Mm. And that's why people love it. And you can't do that online. Even if you're putting like, you know, they say like, oh, put your team member's face in a little, you know, at the checkout so that you feel trust. I'm like, it's not the same as being served by an amazing, you know, team member in store that's got telling you about their life and their interesting things that they're doing as well as serving you. You just can't replicate that.
Yeah.
So we instead tried to think about what our customers use the site for and our digital channels for. So it's more likely to be stocking up of things they've already tried in store, or if they're brand new, we kind of thought, let's make it as simple as possible using words that we know are out there in the market already, like sleep teas and teas for sleep and things. Even though that's not our core proposition, we knew it would get people interested. And then we put a lot of effort once we've got them, whether we've got their, you know, email or maybe they've checked out, to try and encourage them to go in store later, because that's when we know we can give them what we you mean when we say great experience. So it's kind of a backwards way of doing it, I guess. But yeah. Touch wood, so far it's going okay.
Sounds like a very solid plan. Personal question now.
Yeah.
How far north have you opened a store? What's your furthest north, and when are you coming to Edinburgh?
Glasgow.
No way.
Yeah, we have a Glasgow store.
Do you?
Yeah, we just opened it 18 months ago.
That's not just, is it? I should have known that.
Yeah,
oh my
God. That's cool. And Edinburgh's on the list of stores this year.
This year?
Hopefully.
Amazing. Right, well, I'm going to check out
your
Glasgow.
Where do you think we should be in Edinburgh?
God, that's a good question. I think it sounds like, based on what you've described, that Leith would probably be a good place, but also the type of customers that go into an amazing ice cream shop called Mary's Milk Bar, which is on the...
That's right up my street.
Yeah, honestly, it's she went to study making gelato in Italy, and then came back and set up her gelateria in Edinburgh. And it's a really small shop. And it's got you walk out the door and you've got the full castle right in front of you.
Wow.
So it's in the Grass Market.
Yeah.
And what you've described there about having raving fans,
yeah,
she has raving fans,
Grass
right?
Grass Market's come up a few times from people.
So touristy. Okay, cool. And I think probably based on, you know, the fact if you were kind of next door or just further along from Mary's Milk Bar, you'd probably share customers, I would have thought, because sounds like you're going to have a similar...
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. So I said I was going to ask you this question, and we've got so in depth with loads of other stuff that I haven't even asked you it. But I ask everybody that I speak to on this podcast to try and demystify omnichannel, because it is like a bit of a buzzword. What does omnichannel mean for you? What's your definition of omnichannel? And you know, do it either from your own personal perspective or through the lens of Bird and Blend.
Oh, that's a great one. So it's probably not technically accurate, but I think omnichannel to me means showing up for your customers in the way that they need the best you can across all the opportunities that you have to do that. And I don't think it means it has to be the same thing on everything. I think it's just the viewpoint of really seeing the human behind who your customer is and understanding that they want different things from you at different places and times, and that really, if you focus on really seeing them as that whole person, I think that's what omnichannel means to me.
Amazing. Perfect. Thank you so much. It's been brilliant talking to you.
Thank you for having me.
No, it's been great. Thank you.